You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and as always, our opening there was the Soviet national anthem as played in Red Square in 1977 on the 60th anniversary of the October Revolution. And I admit that I was absent last week, and if you were listening in, you would have heard a show I did in 2015, a very important show, I should say, decrying the conservative militarism and celebration of imperialism that surrounds Remembrance Day in this country. But I was not sorry to be absent. For last Saturday, I attended what I can only describe as one of the most moving and significant events that I have ever attended in my whole life. Last Saturday, November the 11th, while the Canadian government did its thing and trotted out its usual parade of sentimentality and lies about the First World War, a war between empires over colonies, in which working class people paid the price and were butchered in their millions on the battlefields of France, Flanders, and Russia. The Communist Party of Canada and its allies instead paid tribute to the 100th anniversary of the great October Socialist Revolution of 1917. It was a packed house. It was at the Winchevsky Center in North York, in the GTA. And the mood was celebratory as we proud and conscious proletarians remembered our greatest victory, a true victory for the people that ushered in a century of anti-colonial, anti-imperialist, and anti-capitalist struggles around the world, and which rose from the darkness of World War I like a red phoenix to light a new path forward for humanity, showing beyond a shadow of a doubt that working class and oppressed people everywhere can fight against their oppressors and can win and can become masters of their own destiny. That is what we celebrated last weekend with our speeches, our musical performances, our dancing, and everything we did. While the ruling class in this country celebrated war and sacrifice for, quote, our home and native land, aka our colonial home on stolen native land, we celebrated revolutionary liberation, international solidarity among peoples, and peace between nations. That's what we celebrated in the Communist Party of Canada. The Canadian ruling class still tells us that we should be proud. The young men went out to fight and die for the colonial expansion of the British Empire. And this is how we should define ourselves as a nation. You know, hearkening to Vimy Ridge and all that. These apologists for empire and colonialism tell us that the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 was evil, totalitarian, and anti-democratic. Many people in this country have grown up with these lies and believe them with all their hearts. But just because a lie is believed by many does not make it true. Just because Canadian schools do not teach their students the real history of anti-colonial, anti-imperialist, and anti-capitalist revolutionary movements of the 20th century, it doesn't mean October, it doesn't mean that they never existed and do not still exist today in this age of neoliberalism, where, of course, capitalism is coming down hard on working people's backs all over the world. I mean, the Great October Socialist Revolution really did happen. And because it happened, the world would never be the same again. And really, the writing was on the wall for the empires that had led the world into war in 1914. Because the people were waking up. All over the world, not just in Russia, working class and oppressed people were waking up, fighting back, and taking control. And the worst nightmares of the bankers, arms dealers, war profiteers, sweatshop owners, colonial plantation elites, aristocrats, and robber barons were coming true. Because the people were standing up, fighting back, and taking control. And the world was becoming very different. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, that was Soviet composer Georgi Sviridov with his piece Time Forward, which really captures the monumental changes which happened in the wake of the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 in Russia and around the world. Now, in the last show I did this month, the last show where I was physically here in the studio, which would have been November 4th, I discussed the significance of the October Revolution of 1917 with regard to the great anti-colonial movements and struggles of the 20th century and how the Soviet Union inspired and supported many of these movements against empire. Today, I'd like to look a little more at the history of the revolution itself and the material conditions in Russia that led to the downfall of Tsarism and ultimately the downfall of Russian capitalism in 1917. It's very important to understand. First of all, it's important to understand that Russia in 1917 was a capitalist country. For while the legacy of feudalism still loomed large, you know, the aristocracy still had considerable power and the majority of the population was still made up of peasant farmers, the profit motive and industrial production were clearly in command by the time the first abortive Russian Revolution took place in 1905. When serfdom ended in Russia in 1861, there were only about 3.5 million urban industrial workers in the empire, less than 5% of the population. But in the next 30 years, their numbers would double. And in the first decade of the 20th century, they would double again. The urban proletariat would be by far the fastest growing segment of Russia's population by the time the First World War broke out in 1914. Many of these workers were former peasants who had fled to the cities in search of work. And again, this was the result of capitalism. After serfdom collapsed in the 1860s, peasants were increasingly unable to survive in an economy dominated by cash transactions, farming small plots of land with crude hand tools and having to pay off massive debts, which they owed to their former masters. You know, that was actually the condition for them being emancipated from serfdom. They actually had to pay off the feudal landlords for freeing them. You know, they had to pay all these debts, and it took years and years and years for many of these people to do it. And of course, many of them couldn't do it. And so they basically had to go to the cities in search of work. And of course, they also had to pay heavy taxes every year to the Tsarist government. And many poorer peasants at this time had no choice but to sell their land and move to the city, while wealthier peasants bought up the land of their neighbors and became landlords. So you basically almost had the emergence of capitalist for-profit farming in the Russian countryside at this time, as like certain peasants became landowners and the rest of them lost everything. That's basically what happened in the second half of the 19th century. Once in the cities, former peasants were forced into slums of industrial centers like St. Petersburg, Moscow, Ivanovo, Voznesk, and others, struggling to pay rent on what were often tiny rooms in which whole families had to share. In the last decade of the 19th century, every one of Russia's heavy industries, iron, steel, coal, oil, railroads, machine tools, and chemicals, doubled or tripled its output, and then doubled it again by 1905. You know, foreign investors poured money into industrial and commercial ventures, and British and French firms even moved to Russia to exploit the cheap labor of its proletarians, basically. For factory workers in Russia had no job security, no legal protections to speak of, no safety regulations, no minimum wage, no pensions, no social security, no protections against child labor, which was widespread, even among kids as young as 3, who worked in plants alongside their mothers. In the matchworks of Vladimir, for example, about 6 out of every 10 workers was under the age of 15, and these child workers could expect to earn less than 1 ruble a month. You know, that was the situation for child workers in Russia 100 years ago. Women often had to give birth on the factory floor because there was no maternity leave. And these women typically made less than 1/3 of the wages that men earned. And for all involved, I mean, for all proletarians, 14, 16, and even 18-hour days were the norm. So that was the situation for proletarians in Russia at that time. And it was from the ranks of these factory workers that the core of the Russian revolutionary movement would be built. In the face of these horrible conditions, proletarians supported each other, taught each other how to read, went on strike together, and organized a militant labor movement together. People like Fedor Smolov, who worked in a textile plant in Ivanovo, and Ivan Babushkin, who worked in an arms foundry in St. Petersburg, people like this would become radicalized by their own hard experiences and go on to join the Bolshevik Party. But it was not just men who became radicalized. By 1907, 20% of the leadership of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party were women. And of that 20%, more than 90% belonged to the Bolsheviks. And I have to remember that there was a split. I mean, I'm not really going to talk about it or go into it today, but around 1900, there was a split in the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. And one faction became the Bolsheviks and one faction became the Mensheviks. And they had different approaches to the revolutionary struggle. Now, the Russian labor movement, consisting almost entirely of illegal workers' leagues and trade unions, grew to the point where it was able to practically shut down the entire country with a general strike in 1905, which very nearly brought the Tsarist government to its knees. In the face of the increased hardship that the 1905 Russo-Japanese War brought to the masses of the Russian people, practically every industrial city in the empire revolted, and the collapse of the regime was only prevented by the loyalty of the army, which killed hundreds, if not thousands, of striking Russian workers, and by concessions to the liberal-minded elite, including the creation of a parliament and a written constitution. None of this eased the plight of ordinary Russian workers, to say nothing of the plight of the peoples colonized by the Russian Empire in Central Asia and the Caucasus region. You know, it's not without a reason that that Lenin called Russia a prison house of nations. There were many oppressed nationalities within the Russian Empire. By the time the workers and peasants of Russia were drafted and sent off to die in their millions in a First World War that they did not want or understand, there was already a strong revolutionary tradition in that country and a powerful history of working class resistance that, in response to the horrors of an imperialist war, would blossom in 1917. This time, the peasant soldiers in the army did not shoot the striking workers, many of whom were women, who marched in the streets of St. Petersburg on International Women's Day in February 1917 to demand bread and an end to the war. This time they shot their own officers and joined the demonstrations. With this mutiny, the Tsar was doomed. And when the new provisional government of Russian elites tried to continue the war in defiance of the people's wishes, the stage was set for the triumph of the Bolsheviks in the great October Socialist Revolution. Because the people wanted out of that war. There was no support for the war in Russia at that time among the masses of the people. They would not tolerate the provisional government continuing the war, and ultimately, anti-war sentiment was one of the main reasons that Russian workers backed the Bolsheviks, who were staunchly anti-war, and who wanted peace, and their slogan was peace, land, and bread, which, of course, were the main concerns of the Russian people at that time. Now, workers' Soviets, and Soviets were councils that represented working people across whole cities and regions. They basically were representative bodies, and which at first appeared during the 1905 general strike. In 1917, these Soviets of workers were joined by mutinous soldiers and basically became an armed force in defiance of the Russian state. And this high level of working class organization would be combined with the leadership of Vladimir Lenin's Bolshevik Party, which ultimately pushed these Soviets to seize power in October of 1917 and create a whole new revolutionary order that would change the world. So the great October Socialist Revolution did not emerge out of thin air, but was the product of decades of organizing, resistance, and struggle by working people against their exploiters. It was born of a working class movement that produced leaders, who, in Lenin's words, were not trade union secretaries, but tribunes of the people. Able to envision a future where workers did not merely bargain with their exploiters, with their bosses, but removed them entirely and seized power. The transformation of militant trade unions into Soviets, representative bodies capable of unifying all workers under one banner, showed the way to a future in which the downtrodden became masters of society. And this struggle would give rise to the world's first socialist state, the USSR. A state that would emancipate workers, emancipate women, grant self-determination to oppressed nations, fight against empire worldwide, defeat fascism in the Second World War, and make the exploitation of workers a crime. While at the same time unleashing the talents of a population that had been one generation before made up mostly of illiterate peasants. Now they were scientists, engineers, teachers, builders, writers, composers. A country which had been locked in the depths of poverty and ignorance for centuries would become the second most developed country on the planet following World War II. It would become a superpower. For the colonized peoples of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, the Great October Socialist Revolution showed what could be done, what could be achieved. It was an example that so many revolutionary and anti-colonial movements looked to. And it's not hard to understand why, if you see that level of development they're coming from that poverty, that ignorance, that oppression. And they're building something new. They're empowering themselves. Showing self-determination. And building a future. That's very, very powerful. A powerful example. And even after the tragic overthrow of socialism in Russia in 1991, which for that country resulted in the greatest economic depression in modern history, it was a catastrophe for the Russian people. Even after that overthrow of socialism, that counter-revolution, that rollback of progressive gains won by the people, the words of a certain French socialist, Jean Jaurès, who was a staunch internationalist who was assassinated in August 1914 for his anti-war views, what he said about the great French Revolution of 1789 could be equally applied to the legacy of the Great October Socialist Revolution of 1917. Jaurès said this about the French Revolution. The France of the Revolution required a century, countless trials, backslidings into monarchy, reawakenings of the Republic, invasions, dismemberments, coups d'etats, and civil wars before it finally arrived at the organization of the Republic, at the establishing of equal liberty through universal suffrage. The great workers of revolution and democracy who labored and fought more than a century ago are not accountable to us for a labor that required several generations to be accomplished. To judge them as if they should have brought the drama to a close, as if history was not going to continue after them, is both childish and unjust. Their work was necessarily limited, but it was great. They affirmed the idea of democracy to its fullest extent. They provided the world with the first example of a great country governing and saving itself through the power of the entire people. They gave the revolution the magnificent prestige of the idea and the indispensable prestige of victory. And they gave France and the world so prodigious an impetus towards freedom that, despite reaction and eclipses, the new rights they established took definitive possession of history. So while the Soviet Union has met its demise, it does not mean that the goal to achieve communism is over. It is up to us, as communists, to complete what the Jacobins and the Bolsheviks could not complete themselves during their time. To establish what the Jacobins proclaimed liberté, égalité, fraternité, and the Bolshevik rallying cry echoing from Karl Marx, workers of the world unite. As communists, it is our duty. It is our duty to carry on the legacy of Lenin and the great October Socialist Revolution and see to it that we will be the ones to establish the dictatorship of the proletariat, which leads to the world communist society in the future. So I say long live Great October on its centenary. Long live Lenin, the leader of the world proletariat. Long live the Socialist Revolution.
Небо утреннего стяг, жизни важен первый шаг. Слышишь, веют над страною ветры яростных атак. И вновь продолжает собой, и сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. Весь летит во все концы, вы поверьте нам, отцы. Будут новые победы, станут новые бойцы. И вновь продолжает собой, сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. С неба милости не жди, жизнь для правды не щади. Нам, ребята, в этой жизни только с правдой по пути. И вновь продолжает собой, и сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
Hey, we are listening to CFLU. We are 93.3 here in Guelph, and this is your campus and community radio.
The North End Harvest Market is excited to announce this year's quarter auction, taking place on Thursday, November 23rd at Trinity United Church, 400 Stevenson Street. The quarter auction is a part raffle, part auction, part fundraiser, and direct sales party. You'll be given a numbered paddle and will have the opportunity to purchase another. Direct sales vendors will have items up for auction, and each will be a one quarter or two quarter bid. If you're interested in the item, you will put your quarters in a bucket and raise your paddle. The announcer will then draw a number, and if it's yours, you win. It's a bit like bingo. There may also be various raffles and cash and carry items available throughout the evening. Arrive at 6 p.m. for the vendor walk. The auction starts at 7. Bring your own quarters, and if you run out, rolls of quarters will be available for purchase. Don't miss the North End Harvest Market's quarter auction on November 23rd at Trinity United Church, a physically accessible location.
Pour les francophones et francophiles de la région, CFRU diffuse l'Éclipse, l'émission musicale française à tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h le matin. Si vous faites partie d'une groupe ou une organisation francophone locale qui veut se faire distinguer ou bien vous voulez contribuer à notre programme, s'il vous plaît, me contactez, Sandra Doucette, par courriel francophone@cfru.ca. Soyez à l'écoute tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h pour les annonces, des événements, d'actualité et bien sûr la bonne musique française.
Attention Guelph and area residents. Dublin Street United Church is hosting a speaker series called Climate Change, The Burning Issue. Facts, Impacts, Actions from 7 to 9 p.m. on four successive Wednesdays starting October 18th. The speakers are University of Toronto physicist Kent Moore on October 18th, Barry Smith and Alexandra Sawatsky on October 25th, Kirby Calvert on November 1st, and Evan Ferrari on November 8th. The talks will explore the emergence and impact of climate change, as well as community-level and personal actions to help combat it. That's Climate Change, The Burning Issue, on successive Wednesdays from October 18th to November 8th at Dublin Street United Church, 68 Suffolk Street West, Guelph, Ontario. Admission is free. This is a physically accessible location.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. And the music that we heard before the break was Lev Lutsenko, Soviet singer, with the song Lenin is Young Again, paying tribute to the October Socialist Revolution of 1917. And because I mentioned it before, I think because I mentioned 1905 and the crucial role that even though the Russian Revolution of 1905 failed, the crucial role that it played in really setting the stage for what happened in 1917, you know, the crucial stage that it represented in terms of developing working class organization in Russia and their ability to fight back against the oppressive system that they faced. 1905 was a very crucial experience, developmental experience for the working class movement in Russia. And I would like to just seeing I have the time now, I want to actually tell the story of a very, very famous incident which took place. It was very, very symbolically, was very, very powerful in what it represented in 1905, in the course of that the struggles of that year. And this, of course, was the mutiny on the battleship Potemkin, which, of course, was immortalized in Sergei Eisenstein's film in the 1920s. But the story of the battleship Potemkin, and the mutiny on that ship broke out a few months after the struggles began in Russia's working class cities, where Between May Day and the beginning of September, the Russian countryside was swept via violence while strikes held many towns and provincial manufacturing centers in their grip. Almost 750,000 workers were on strike during those months. And virtually everywhere, troops fired on striking workers. You know, and literally hundreds were killed as the working class rose up across Russia and struggled for justice. Struggled against the powers that had been oppressing them. And Tsar Nicholas II's regime seemed secure, because so far, the armed forces had remained loyal. But on June 14th, the crew of the battleship Potemkin mutinied in the Black Sea harbor of Odessa. And all of a sudden, the Tsar was worried he couldn't even count on his own soldiers and sailors to follow orders. So I'm going to read from the section from a book, In War's Dark Shadow, The Russians Before the Great War, by W. Bruce Lincoln, an American historian. This is what he writes about the mutiny on the Potemkin. That Russia's first serious military descent should occur in the Navy rather than in the Army may seem surprising. The Navy usually required more training, more education, and longer terms of service from those who served in its ranks, and even draftees were obliged to stay on active duty for 7 years before they were released into the reserves. During such long terms of service, sailors grew accustomed to the Navy's severe discipline. It was almost unthinkable for a sailor to refuse an order, and doing so meant almost certain death by firing squad. In an army weakened by bloody fighting in the Far East, remember this is during the Russian-Japanese War, weakened by fighting in the Far East and plagued by shortages of weapons, supplies, and medicine that cost thousands of lives, mutiny seemed far more of a real possibility than it did in the well-disciplined Black Sea Fleet, whose sailors had been spared the peril of battle because international conventions denied their ships entry into the Mediterranean Sea and the oceans which lay beyond. Yet safety from battle had other consequences for men more literate than their counterparts in other branches of Russia's military service. The lower decks of the Black Sea Fleet included a well-developed network of radical discussion groups and revolutionary cells. Sailors of this fleet were no strangers to revolutionary propaganda, and a number were deeply attracted by it. With a crew of 768, the Potemkin was one of the newest and most modern ships in the Black Sea Fleet. So many of her senior sailors and petty officers had been taken off to serve on Admiral Rozhdestvensky's short-handed Baltic cruisers when they were sent out to the Far East. That by early 1905, only one crewman out of five was an experienced hand, while the rest had only recently been taken from their native villages. These men were neither well-disciplined nor well-trained, and they were unaccustomed to the hardships of Navy life. Their commander, Captain E.N. Golikov, was a notoriously stern disciplinarian who made no allowances for the difficulties faced by awkward peasant lads in learning to become sailors. As word of disorders elsewhere in Russia began to reach the Black Sea ports, Golikov endeavored to isolate the Potemkin sailors from the revolution by confining them aboard ship whenever they docked. And his restrictions became especially severe when a general strike broke out in Odessa that spring. On June 12th, a number of workers were killed by rifle fire in confrontations between strikers and troops while the Potemkin was anchored in Odessa Harbor. And the next day, a party of seamen who had been sent ashore to buy provisions returned and brought word of the killings. They also brought meat that was crawling with maggots, from which Golikov ordered the ship's kitchen to prepare the sailors' midday meal. That night, the men resolved not to accept worm-filled rations the next day. When they carried out their resolution, Golikov ordered his guards to open fire, and the sailors' peaceful protest became a violent mutiny. led by a handful of revolutionary sailors, that Potemkin's crew arrested Golikov and seized his ship. For the first time in Russia's history, the red banner of revolt waved from the mast of an imperial ship of war, while, for 2 days, Odessa suffered what may have been the bloodiest fighting of the entire year. Yet Potemkin sailors were involved in the Odessa street battles only incidentally, and most of the nearly 2,000 who fell in the conflict were strikers and their sworn enemies on the far right, the Black Hundreds. The Potemkin sailors tried to bring their heavy guns to bear in support of the strikers, but failed. Nor were their efforts to win over the rest of the Black Sea fleet any more successful. Unable to turn their mutiny into the beginning of an armed rebellion, of which Russia's revolutionaries had dreamed of for so long, that Potemkin's crew sailed out of Odessa Harbor. 10 days later, they docked at the Romanian port of Constanta to take on water and provisions. Unable to obtain supplies, they surrendered to the local authorities. The Romanians refused irate Russian demands for the extradition of the Potemkin mutineers, and most of them emigrated to the United States, Canada, and Brazil. Although the Potemkin mutiny did not mark the beginning of a larger rebellion, the ship, its crew, and the strikers of Odessa became much-needed symbols for revolutionaries at home and abroad in their struggle against Nicholas's government. As summer approached, that struggle shifted to Russia's countryside and to a number of provincial cities, where it became more fragmented, more destructive, and more brutal. And between October 7 and October 17th in 1905, the entire Russian Empire was paralyzed by a spontaneous strike movement that involved millions of workers. The railroad men struck in the Moscow-Kazan Railroad on the morning of October 7, and in support of their effort, some 11,000 printers and silversmiths left their presses and benches. "Into the fray, join the struggle for freedom, comrades," they proclaimed. "Moscow is the heart of Russia. It will become the heart of a mass rebellion." Almost as if someone had set up vast strings of dominoes along all the railway lines that spread out from Moscow like the spokes of a wheel, and then had knocked over the one standing in the very center, the strike spread outward in scarcely more time than it took for the trains to travel. It reached Kursk, Nizhny Novgorod, Kiev, Ryazan, and Voronezh on the 9th, St. Petersburg and Kharkov on the 10th. By October 14th, it had breached the Urals and the Caucasus Mountains and had flowed into Georgia, Central Asia, and Siberia. Traffic came to a standstill along some 26,000 miles of track as 750,000 railroad employees laid down their tools and walked away from their work. In a number of provincial towns and cities, workers took up pistols and sabers and went onto the streets to meet force with force. The red banners of revolution rose above their ranks as they sang La Marseillaise and proclaimed freedom, life, or death. Down with autocracy and long live the revolution. No longer were Russia's laboring men and women willing to settle for better pay and working conditions. In October, they called for the right to determine their fate and that of their fellows. While political demands had been notably absent from workers' protests earlier in the year, well over half of the strikers in October demanded that Nicholas grant political concessions. As the protests continued, Nicholas continued to do nothing to meet the workers' demands. By the time the railway workers' strike had reached Siberia and Central Asia, much of European Russia was in the grip of one of the greatest and most effective general strikes in the history of labor protest anywhere in the world. All of Russia's industry ground to a halt. All of her public services ceased to function. In St. Petersburg, virtually everyone left work. Factory workers, servants, postal workers, telegraph operators, janitors, and hackney drivers all walked off their jobs, as did bank clerks, shop clerks, and clerks in government offices. Doctors, lawyers, school teachers, university professors, even the entire corps de ballet of the great Imperial Mariinsky Theater all joined the strike. So that was how effective the revolution of 1905 was in terms of mobilizing working class support, and the battleship Potemkin, the mutiny on the battleship Potemkin, which revealed that even the Russian government couldn't even rely on the support of the army, of the armed forces. That was becoming shaky, and now there were actually sailors and soldiers who were going to mutiny and refuse to fire on the striking workers and refuse to obey orders. That was a turning point in the revolutionary movement in Russia. And of course, it would be taken to even new heights in 1917, where the entire army effectively would mutiny and refuse to fire at the striking workers in February 1917, and would then join with the workers' Soviets in creating the conditions for the October Socialist Revolution. This is very significant. 1905 was very significant in building the foundation for 1917. And while I don't have an actual song about the Battleship Potemkin and the mutiny that took place, I do have a song called Solidarity, which is a song by the Stage Bottles, British punk band, and this talks about the showing solidarity with working class struggles everywhere. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Any workers fight to make a stand, and behind them every honest working man. In unity with each other, and your friend becomes your brother, and in the tyrant's heart will be a lesson learned. Give them hope, give them strength, give them life. Like a candle burning in the black of night, we're all with you in our hearts and in our minds. And we'll pray for the workers through the darkest time. And I know your fighters make of a firmer kind, and no riot stick will kill your peace of mind. You can fight with all the spirit that you possess, 'cause your fight's a struggle that is blessed. So give them hope, give them strength, give them life. Like a candle burning in the black of night. Yes, we are with you in our hearts and in our minds. And we'll pray for the workers through the darkest time. The tyrant has no smile upon his face, 'cause he knows that in his mind he's in disgrace. The religion of union will take their breath away. Our time will come and then we'll have our say. So give them hope, give them strength, give them life. Like a candle burning in the black of night, we're all with you in our hearts and in our minds. And we'll pray for the workers through the darkest time.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
You're listening to CFRU
93.3 in Guelph, Ontario.
The North End Harvest Market is excited to announce this year's quarter auction, taking place on Thursday, November 23rd at Trinity United Church, 400 Stevenson Street. The quarter auction is a part raffle, part auction, part fundraiser and direct sales party. You'll be given a numbered paddle and will have the opportunity to purchase another. Direct sales vendors will have items up for auction and each will be a one quarter or two quarter bid. If you're interested in the item, you will put your quarters in a bucket and raise your paddle. The announcer will then draw a number and if it's yours, you win. It's a bit like bingo. There may also be various raffles and cash and carry items available throughout the evening. Arrive at 6 p.m. for the vendor walk. The auction starts at 7. Bring your own quarters, and if you run out, rolls of quarters will be available for purchase. Don't miss the North End Harvest Market's quarter auction on November 23rd at Trinity United Church, a physically accessible location.
Pour les francophones et francophiles de la région, CFRU diffuse l'Éclipse, l'émission musicale française à tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h le matin. Si vous faites partie d'une groupe ou une organisation francophone locale qui veut se faire distinguer ou bien vous voulez contribuer à notre programme, s'il vous plaît, me contactez, Sandra Doucette, par courriel francophone@cfru.ca. Soyez à l'écoute tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h pour les annonces, des événements, d'actualité et bien sûr la bonne musique française.
Attention Guelph and area residents. Dublin Street United Church is hosting a speaker series called Climate Change, The Burning Issue. Facts, Impacts, Actions from 7 to 9 p.m. on four successive Wednesdays starting October 18th. The speakers are University of Toronto physicist Kent Moore on October 18th, Barry Smith and Alexandra Sawatsky on October 25th, Kirby Calvert on November 1st, and Evan Ferrari on November 8th. The talks will explore the emergence and impact of climate change, as well as community-level and personal actions to help combat it. That's Climate Change, The Burning Issue, on successive Wednesdays from October 18th to November 8th at Dublin Street United Church, 68 Suffolk Street West, Guelph, Ontario. Admission is free. This is a physically accessible location.
Classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit. I'm sending heads into backspin, attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts. Packed with the stat charts and graphs, I got passion, burn mics up to ashes. I make fascists clap their pants, stanzas, cure cultural cancer. I got tunes that move you to dance, burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum. Getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis. My word pack like nominally gat, rhymingly packed. Punch, crash the fun by metric tons and plus my math. Distribute cash among the classes. Take from the thieving greedy bastard. Give back like church has to get past. Collapse structure, fuck facades. I destruct the support beams and bars. Wrecking ball large, resistance. Subversive diction. Flip the shit just like a brick throne. Dethrone kings, bring the trees on. My tone rock like Gibraltar pop. Hip hop hotter than a rocket shot. I'm crime, think, fraud, bring the big talk. Teach you to flee from the flock, walk off. Switch shit, hit my target. Drop like bombs in the form of carpets. I got the target locked on that all shit. Pump your fist if you know where we are. That's a wrap.
Boom Bap, original rap at Boom, taking it back. Boom Bap, Boom Bap. I'm talking true path, master the craft. The pupil, the pro, keep dropping math. Boom bap, blast the bazooka rap.
Boom bap, original rap. Boom bap, original rap. Boom bap, original rap. Boom bap, original rap.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Lee Reed with Bazooka Rap, and of course we had Stage Bottles with Solidarity, which I played before the break. Now, a lot of what I've been talking about here, like with regard to the historical foundations of the October Socialist Revolution of 1917. I mean, it is about history, but of course this history does have relevance in the world around us now. I mean, history is a contested thing when it comes to class struggle. History is contested. You know, we have the mainstream historical narrative, which of course paints, which is the viewpoint of the ruling class and like the interests of basically the profit motive and the capitalist system, which basically looks upon not just the Russian Revolution and like but on all attempts to redistribute wealth and create a more equitable system for human beings as abominations, you know, to be, you know, opposed and fought at all costs. You know, we have that viewpoint, and then of course we have the viewpoint of the people who actually have been fighting for their liberation, like liberation from colonialism, liberation against empire, liberation from oppressive working conditions and from exploitation.